Good afternoon, good evening, and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Thursday, February 2nd, 2017. The widow of the founder of South Sudan says the country is at the verge of mass killing.
Genocide is looming in our country because nobody is seeing it. And the whole world and the region are quiet about it. I don't know whether we have not learned from what happened in Rwanda.
And the new UN Secretary General weighs on the efforts to secure peace in South Sudan.
You can imagine how tragic it is to see now South Sudan in a dramatic situation with the real perspectives of things getting even worse. You have seen the reports of our special representative on genocide.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The new UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, says the United Nations is working to avoid what he calls the worst for South Sudan. Speaking to reporters at UN headquarters in New York City upon his return from the just-concluded African Union summit in Addis Ababa, Guterres says his office will ensure that the conflict in South Sudan is resolved through peaceful means. He says the people of South Sudan deserve peace.
When I became High Commissioner for Refugees, my first act was to go to Uganda to celebrate World Refugee Day with South Sudanese refugees. And we helped 500,000 South Sudanese go back home when the country was created, that a lot of hope was inspiring them.
He says the country is at a crossroad with the potential of large-scale humanitarian intervention to save lives of innocent South Sudanese civilians caught up in fighting between the warring parties.
You can imagine how tragic it is to see now South Sudan in a dramatic situation with the real perspectives of things getting even worse. You have seen the reports of our special representative on genocide. At the same time, to see how difficult it has been to create the conditions for the South Sudan situation to be put on track for a peaceful resolution.
The top UN diplomat says he was in Addis Ababa to talk to African Union and IGAD leaders to look for ways to address the political instability in South Sudan.
And so one of my objectives was to try to establish a sound mechanism of cooperation between the sub-regional organization, IGAD, the African Union, and the UN in order to be able to do everything possible to avoid the worst in South Sudan and to bring the South Sudanese situation into a better track for peace.
That was UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres speaking to reporters at UN headquarters in New York yesterday. Meanwhile, here in Washington, the widow of South Sudan's founding father, Dr. John Garang, says the new U.S. president should pay attention to the crisis in South Sudan. Rebecca Nyandeng Dimabior says genocide is looming in the country. She says she disagrees with the assessment of the Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission that the 2015 peace agreement is being implemented. Nyandeng says the international community must act now before it's too late.
If I could get an opportunity, it's just I want him to lend me his ear to hear what is going on in South Sudan. Because I know Donald Trump categorically told us America first. But we just want him to lend us his ear about what is happening in South Sudan. Humanitarian situation, human lives which are being lost unnecessarily, senseless war which is going on in our country. But we want peace. Nobody wants war. People of South Sudan, majority of them are now at each other's throats. But if we could stop it, if anybody could come to aid to the aid of these people of South Sudan, I think it will be good. This is why I'm here. I'm for peace.
The UN representatives on genocide rang the bell last year saying that the country is at the verge of mass killing. And you're just saying that people are on each other's throats. Who is fighting who?
You will not say which community, because I stated earlier that 64 tribes of South Sudan are at each other's throats. And the panel of experts of UN are right, because genocide is looming in our country, because nobody is seeing it. And the whole world and the region are quiet about it. I don't know whether we have not learned from what happened in Rwanda. When the genocide is pronounced after the genocide have taken place. We thought that South Sudan will be rescued because we have seen in our region what had happened in Rwanda. We don't want the same situation to happen in South Sudan. But the whole world and our region and Africa is quiet about it. I don't know how many people do we want to die. Because if you go now to the country, most of the people are in displaced people's camp, UN camp, and refugees camp. I have not seen a country devastated like that. Even during the War of Liberation, I have not seen something like that.
Talking about the War of Liberation, most of the leaders in the country now, including President Salva Kiir, have been very close to you. One time you were his advisor, and I still believe you are in that position. You're still the advisor of the president. Are you talking to him? Are you talking to the other leaders who were with you during the struggle?
I'm not. I just wanted to correct that. I'm not his advisor anymore. I was sacked sometimes back, I think 2015 or 2014, where all the other leaders were sacked in the government. I have not been talking to Salva, but I have been talking to South Sudanese leaders because I consider myself the mother of the people of South Sudan. So I talk with everybody, whoever that I met, I always talk to them. I don't have boundaries of saying that so-and-so is good, so-and-so is bad. As a mother, everybody is your child.
And which political party do you represent? I understand there is the SPLM-IO, the SPLM in opposition, the political detainees. Dr. Lam Macaulay has his own outfit. Which party do you represent when you talk to the South Sudanese?
They are all my children. I'm not for any party. I'm for all the people of South Sudan. And what is hurting them hurts me the most. Because my husband and I went to the bush to liberate the very people that we are hurting today. So I will not say that I'm standing with that or with this. I'm not for any party. I'm for people of South Sudan.
What is your assessment of the Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission, JMAC, that has been appointed by the international community to oversee the implementation of the peace agreement?
I would say that Assessment and Evaluation Commission was doing their job, but they have been frustrated. They were doing their job, but I will not agree with them that agreement is being implemented. Because those who are now in the government are not those who were signing, who had signed the agreement. Because those parties who signed the agreement were Dr. Riek and President Salva. And Dr. Riek is not there anymore. Taban has taken the place. He said that he has taken the place of Dr. Riek, but it's not true. Because Taban is not carrying the majority of IO with him. So, and then also, if you could see with your naked eye, if Taban was and the government are implementing the agreement, why is the people still in the UN camps? People are not coming out. Why is there is still problem on the roads of South Sudan? People are being ambushed and being killed. Why is that like that? If there was such thing, people would have come out from the camps, the roads would be clear, and those who do not want to go in will see, and they will be asked, why are you not going? Look at this, what is happening in your country. You will not even be asking me those questions. You will be asking me, Madam Rebecca, things are now good in the country. Why are you not going in?
That was Rebecca Nyandeng Dimabior, former advisor of President Salva Kiir. She was speaking to me this past hour in our studio here in Washington. In an open letter, some 69 governmental organizations are demanding that the African Union help South Sudan move forward with President Salva Kiir's national dialogue. But an influential former U.S. official says the conditions for a meaningful national dialogue do not exist in South Sudan. Ayen Bior has more from Washington.
When President Kiir announced a national dialogue in December, he said the process would involve all South Sudanese and that, quote, eminent personalities and people of consensus, end quote, would guide the national dialogue. Princeton Lyman, a former U.S. special envoy to Sudan and South Sudan, is skeptical that a national dialogue would be effective under the current restrictive environment in South Sudan.
There's no peace. There's no freedom of movement. There's no freedom of expression. It would be hard to put together under these conditions a effective national dialogue. Nevertheless, they've called upon two credible civil society groups to work with them, And if those groups can lay out the conditions necessary for a national dialogue, maybe then there's some hope there.
Although President Kiir asked for forgiveness for any wrongdoing he may have committed over the last 3+ years of conflict during an end-of-the-year speech in Juba, he did not mention how his administration would provide justice for the crimes committed during the conflict. Dismas Nkunda, a Kampala-based executive director of Atrocities Watch Africa and one of the signatories of the open letter to the AU, says asking for forgiveness is a good start, but South Sudan has a long way to go. He says NGOs by nature do not have vested political interest in any country, including South Sudan, but shedding light on atrocities on both sides and holding politicians accountable would be a big step in the right direction. He says the African Union should exercise its right to intervene in South Sudan to create the circumstances so that citizens feel free to speak up without fear of retribution.
They do have the mechanisms through which they can do that. It's not difficult. They have done it recently. The ECOWAS did it recently in Gambia, and it happened. The AU can still do it in South Sudan and then bring normalcy in that country.
Repeated attempts were made to reach Information Minister Michael McQuay for comment. The first time, McQuay answered the phone, but asked to be called back at an agreed-to later time.
I'm sorry, I will not be in a position to comment now. I'm at the airport. Call me after 2 hours.
On the second call, 2 hours later, McQuay did not answer. Nkunda says President Kiir and former First Vice President Riek Machar will have to set aside their differences if any meaningful change is to occur in South Sudan.
We know people have had so many egos in the past, and those egos have been really defeated. So even them, they can be brought to think much more about South Sudan than their individual pursuit of becoming leaders of that country or permanently becoming enemies. They have been in the same government before. It can still happen.
The way for that to happen, Nkunda says, is for a national dialogue to be conducted in a clear, credible, independent, and impartial manner, with all major stakeholders in agreement on how they will work together to restore peace and stability in South Sudan. Ayen Bior, VOA News, Washington.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, residents in Torit are grateful for relief aid, saying they now have courage to stay in South Sudan. That story is coming up next.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
do you make emotional decisions or logical ones?
I make both, but I think I make more logical decisions than the emotional ones.
I mostly make emotional decisions, and it mostly works out. I don't really regret making it.
These two, they always move simultaneously. The emotional one, when you lost the dear one, of course, you will be painted, and you will lose your control. You'll be imbalanced, and when you are in balance, you will not actually have the control of your emotion, and there you find yourself losing the emotion.
Sometimes I make emotional decisions, but I later regret that.
I don't lash in making decisions. I sit down and think on how I'm going to make that decision to be a proper and a good one.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. A humanitarian organization, CARE International, is providing basic household items, including blankets, cooking pots, water containers, and canvas to shelter hundreds of families displaced from their homes by violence in Imatong State. Residents say the aid being provided gives them the courage to stay in South Sudan. Dimo Silva Aurelio has more for VOA from Torit.
Most families receiving aid from CARE International are in Ilangi, Ifonyak, and Inyif areas located east and west of Torit town. Helen Ichol, a single mother of six, says when fighting broke out in Torit in July, she lost her livestock and poultry, which used to be her only source of income. Ichol says she used to sell a chicken or a goat whenever her family ran short of money to buy food. She did the same thing to raise money for the children's school fees. Speaking in Arabic, Ichol says that all changed when violence broke out.
I lost money, duck and chicken. We did not only need materials for shelter and saucepan, but any other help.
Ichol says when deadly fighting erupted last July, she considered going to a refugee camp either in Uganda or Kenya, but could not afford the cost of transport. Now that humanitarian organizations like CARE International are providing assistance, she says she plans to stay in South Sudan.
Thanks these people who have brought for us this assistance. I will use this tabling to construct a shelter for my children and also to preserve flora.
Margaret Anthony is a resident of Ifonyak in Torit. Anthony was given a sleeping mat, blanket and cooking utensils from CARE International. Speaking in Arabic, Anthony says she too is grateful for what she has received, but she fears going out into the bush to collect firewood and grass.
There is no way for us to go to the bush. Those who risk going to the bush are often arrested by criminals in the bush.
Marco Oromo, another resident displaced from his home, praises CARE International for their help in providing basic materials to people unable to buy things for themselves. Speaking in Arabic, Oromo blames South Sudan's leaders for causing their suffering.
We cannot go to Kakuma refugee camp because this is our country. And this problem is South Sudan is just about each other. We cannot leave this country which the world has given to us, and now we are spoiling it. I want our leaders to help us, and the organization like this one should continue helping our children. However little assistance is, they should continue to assist.
CARE International's field operations manager, Rokibul Alan, says helping IDPs within South Sudan can minimize the influx of South Sudanese crossing into neighboring countries. Alan says the aid his organization provides might not sustain the IDPs, but will help them stabilize their families as they try to start new lives.
We are providing 7 items to the beneficiaries, basically the non-food items, which is blanket, sleeping mat, kitchen set, and then kangas, and plastic sheet, sleeping mats, all these sort of items. So we already distributed 1,000 of families, 989 families basically before. So this time we are going to distribute 852 beneficiaries in 3 areas.
Alan says food shortages, the deteriorating economy and ongoing insecurity are to blame for the influx of Imatong State residents into refugee camps in neighboring countries.
Food is the biggest need considering the present economic situation. We conducted a market assessment here in Torit and we found that the inflation is very high. The materials are not available. The supply system is not working properly due to the insecurity on the road from Juba and from the other part. So as a result, we understand, but as an agency, we have got some limitation as well.
Alan says CARE International secured funds from USAID and the World Food Program to assist thousands of internally displaced persons in Imatong State. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Torit.
A representative of South Sudanese women living in Sudan says women suffer a great deal as they try to take care of their families and earn some kind of living under harsh conditions. In the fourth and final part of our series on South Sudanese refugees in Sudan, Nabil Biagio speaks to women about the daily challenges they face at the Sudan Jadid and Andulus camps in Jebel Awliya, south of Khartoum.
Lydia Leon Taban says, in many cases, women living in the Sudanese camps are the breadwinners for their families because their men cannot find jobs. Speaking in Arabic, Taban says, other women must fend for themselves and their children because, like herself, they are widows.
I have 7 children. Their father was killed in Juba in July 2016, so I'm a widow. But I still thank God and live off what I can do with my own hands, even that which the government of Sudan doesn't like us doing. I do it to earn little money for me and my kids.
Taban earns money to buy food for her family by making a locally brewed alcohol that she and other South Sudanese women sell at the camps. But since the Khartoum government banned the sale or possession of alcohol in the camps, business is not so good.
Women are so restricted and disadvantaged. They can't do much. Just earlier today, there was a police raid. They beat some women and picked up some for questioning.
Taban says she and the other women living at the camps would gladly give up the business of making and selling alcohol if they could find another way to pay for their family's needs.
We had a workshop here at the camp organized by Khadija Organization for Handcraft. They taught us how to bake cookies and make other food items for sale, but they didn't provide us with all the equipment we need. We thank them for what they have done, but we need more help to make the best out of what we have learned.
Al-Amin Agai is a resident of Sudan Jadid camp. Speaking in Arabic, he says he primarily depends on his two wives for feeding him and his children.
I have two wives who stay with me here at the camp. I have six kids. Two of them are in South Sudan, and four stay with me here. One of my wives goes out to work as a housemaid, and the other one tries to work from inside the camp. I am jobless. Sometimes I find work to do, but most of the time I just sit around doing nothing.
UNHCR representative in Khartoum, Noriko Yoshida, says she is working to secure funds for projects that will provide skills training and a bit of startup capital to enable women like Taban to earn a modest living.
It is very important for us to have a balance while we are meeting the immediate life-saving activities, not to lose sight, also to support them through education or income-generating activities so that in the long run, they can be more self-sufficient. But when we have a very, very limited funds, our focus tend to be life-saving activities.
In 2016, Yoshida says UNHCR and its partners determined that they needed about $157 million to meet the needs of South Sudanese refugees living in Khartoum and other parts of Sudan. But she says only 23% of that amount was secured. Yoshida says roads also become impassable during the rainy season, making it difficult to reach South Sudanese refugees around Khartoum and in other states.
What is important for us is that to implement the activities even before the rainy season comes. So in my view, also not only the amount of the funds, but also the timeliness or the timing of the receiving the funds is going to determine the impact of our activities.
The rainy season in Sudan begins around May and lasts until October. UNHCR says the beginning of the year, around January and February, is the best time for donors to give money because the funds will have a maximum impact on the South Sudanese refugees before the rainy season sets in. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Juba.
We turn to Kenya now, where a massive project is underway to link the country with neighboring Ethiopia and South Sudan, and later even West Africa. The LAPSSET corridor consists of a 32-berth port in Lamu on the northern coast of Kenya, a railway, highways, oil pipeline, international airports, and resort cities. The program promises economic growth, but some are raising concern about the environmental impact and whether local communities will share the prosperity. Jill Craig reports for VOA from Nairobi.
It is a massive infrastructure project originating from Kenya, consisting of a 32-berth port on the country's north coast, a railway, an oil pipeline, highways, international airports, and resort cities. LAPSSET stands for Lamu Port South Sudan Ethiopia Transport Corridor, and this project is set to connect Kenya with South Sudan, Ethiopia, and eventually West Africa. One of the project's creators, Gershon Ikiara, was Kenya's permanent secretary for the Ministry of Transport from 2003 to 2008.
For a long time,
the products, both export and import, going to those countries and other countries within East Africa. They have been uncompetitive in international markets because of the cost of transportation, which has been taking as much as 30% of the value of those products. It will make the countries, the region's exports, much more efficient and rise in value and so forth.
A Lapset spokesman says dredging of the first berth at the new Lamu port began in 2016. A new road linking Isiolo to Moyale on the border of Ethiopia was finished in September. He says the new Isiolo airport is ready to start operations. Steve McDonald, a global fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, says the project could be a great advantage for the region, but circumstances have changed since the plan's inception.
The security situation in East Africa, border situations between South Sudan and Kenya, the border situations between South Sudan and Ethiopia, the refugee flows into Uganda and Kenya and Ethiopia, the security situation is very, very dicey, and that is going to be a real challenge.
But Ikiara believes the project may improve security.
It is likely to open up the war of northern Kenya, which for a long time has been a neglected area, and even help to possibly improve security and increase other economic activities.
But other issues are at stake. In 2012, the group Save Lamu filed a petition against the government, warning of environmental degradation, unprecedented levels of population growth, and of the destruction of the town's cultural heritage. Lamu, whose old town is listed as a UNESCO World Heritage Site, survives on tourism. The Kenyan government has compensated local landowners, with some receiving the relatively large sum of about $14,500 for one-acre plots. And the government is sending locals for training programs to make them employable. Lapset is an estimated $24 billion project, relying heavily on public-private partnership initiatives for funding. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
That's our show for this Thursday. We now leave you with the song "And a Guide" by Crazy Fox. We have been listening to Crazy Fox with the song "And a Guide." I'm John Tanza in Washington. We hope you enjoyed the show. Tune in again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Miss Kindy, and I'll be far up here.